Hello and welcome. My name is Jane Fraser. I'm the CEO at Fremantle Press, and good morning. It's great to see so many people here today for this session. Thank you for coming. I respectfully acknowledge the past and present traditional custodians of the land on which we are meeting today, the Whadjuk Noongar people. It's a privilege to stand on Noongar country. So today's seminar is brought to you by the Department of Local Government, Recreation, Sport and Cultural Industries and is part of the Four Centres Emerging Writers Program, which has been administered by us at Fremantle Press in association with the Fellowship of Australian Writers WA, the KSP Writer Centre, the Peter Cowans Writer Centre and WA Poets Inc. We'd also like to thank the team at Perth Festival's Literature and Ideas Weekend for hosting us. So I've got a bit of background and housekeeping to give you, and then we'll get right into it. So what's in store today is that there will be four panel sessions on a variety of publishing topics. Two sessions this morning will be followed by a 15-minute break for coffee and tea, and then two more in the afternoon with a break in between for lunch. You can ask questions at the end of each session while allowing plenty of time. And we're being recorded today, so please speak into the microphone that'll be handed around by one of our volunteers. During the lunch break, Fremantle Press marketing manager Claire Miller and publisher Georgia Richter will be on hand to answer any questions, including questions about the 2020 City of Fremantle Hungerford Award, which is currently open to all debut writers from WA and is worth $15,000 and a publishing contract with Fremantle Press. We also have representatives of from the four writers' centres over there, plus representatives from the WA Society of Editors to talk to you about joining a writing group or applying for a residency or finding an editor. So please make sure you head that way if you haven't already for a chat. This year we listened to what you wanted from last year and we have prepared a whole new set of topics to complement last year's 2019 Business of Being a Writer. In 2019, we covered topics such as marketing and social media for authors. We had a session on grants, residencies and fellowships, and a session about writing for the stage and screen. If you're interested in learning more about those topics, the marketing team has made each panel session available on the Fremantle Press podcast, which you can subscribe to via iTunes, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, or anywhere where you normally get your audio content. Okay, some housekeeping. Your ticket entitles you to one, two, or all four panel sessions. For the sake of your fellow writers and all our speakers, please time your entries and exits to coincide with all our breaks. Tea, coffee, and biscuits are available all day. If you can, please use your cup if you have one all day. Keep it, recycle it. And grab a coffee over there at any time during the sessions. In the event of emergency, there are exits in all four corners of the building and the muster point is at the top of Whitfield Court. You'll find toilets that if you need to go out via two doors at the back of the room, I think that one's probably the best one, and you go up and back and around the edge there, and there's an accessible toilet. There. Now, Boffin's Bookshop is the official bookseller for this event and you can purchase books by all our authors today at the Perth Festival bookstore down there. At the end of the seminar, you'll be sent an online questionnaire. Your comments are crucial to how we plan our events and are an essential part of attracting the necessary sponsorship that allows us to continue to produce seminars like this one. So we'd really appreciate if you find time to fill those questionnaires out. Mobile phones, please switch to silent. But wait. Keep them out because there are prizes to be won. We encourage all of you to tweet, Insta story share, TikTok and BookTubify to your heart's content by tagging us at Fremantle Press. Refer to your handouts about hashtags and handles. We're providing an amazing prize for the most creative social media post about today's events. Or if you're not on social media, simply write on the back of a post-it note to our What I Learned from the Business of Being a Writer board and hand it up to the social media table, which is up the back on that side. The most creative post or post-it note wins. And the prize is a behind-the-scenes tour of Fremantle Press and one whole hour with Fremantle Press publisher Georgia Richter and marketing and communications manager Claire Miller, during which time you can ask them anything you want about writing, publishing, marketing your own work. So, let's start. The first panel is all about, for you, pretending that you've just landed a contract with a publisher. You're extremely excited and elated. But then a 10-page document of legalese lands in your inbox. You might be tempted to sign it and send it back immediately without reading it or any of the fine print because you're so excited. Or even if you do read the fine print, you might not know what anything means. So today's panel is about copyright, contracts and subsidiary rights, and I'm joined by Craig Silvey and Alan Carter. Craig is a critically acclaimed debut novelist of Rhubarb, which was published by Fremantle Press in 2004. His best-known book, Jasper Jones, was published in over a dozen territories and is an internationally acclaimed bestseller, a stage play and an award-winning movie. Craig's graphic novella, The Amber Amulet, was awarded a Crystal Bear in the Berlin International Film Festival, and that Craig continues to work in film with two features in development. So we'll be talking a lot about that later. Born in Sunderland in the UK, Alan Carter immigrated to Australia in 1991 and now lives just south of Hobart. He's an experienced television documentary maker and director and the author of four Philip Cato Kwong novels, Prime Cut, Getting Warmer, Bad Seed and Heaven Sent, as well as the Nick Chester novels Marlborough Man and Doom Creek, which is out later this year. Alan has won the Ned Kelly Award for Best First Fiction for Prime Cut and a Naya Marsh Award for Best Crime Novel for Marlborough Man. His crime novels have been published in Europe and the UK. So I'm going to sit down and we're going to have a chat. We're going to talk about some sort of basic things that interest Alan and Craig, and there'll be plenty of questions afterwards for you to hit us with the nitty-gritty of contracts or copyright or whatever we might not have discussed. Right. So, Craig and Alan, when you received your very first contract, did you read it in detail or did you just skip through it, sign it and gleefully hand it back? Do you want to go first, Alan?
I think when I first got the contract, I went into a kind of a faint swoon and then I ran around the house squealing for a while. And no, I didn't read it at all. I just signed on the dotted line. That was fine by me. But I did have a background as a documentary maker in that kind of contract, so I did actually scan, read it, see if anything dangerous in there. As far as I could tell, there wasn't. But yeah, pretty much kind of
trusted us.
I grabbed it with both hands.
This is what the document looks like. It's 10 pages of Craig.
And first of all, welcome everybody to the sauna of knowledge.
It is, isn't it?
I'm pleasantly surprised to see so many people here at a panel event about contracts. Given that I couldn't be bothered reading my first one, I find this quite inspiring. I was about 12 when you offered me my first contract. So, and I think the offer was a juice box and a yo-yo. So I was pretty happy with that. No, I, a lot like Alan, I just was so overwhelmed and proud and thrilled to have the opportunity to have my novel on the shelf that the notion of arguing the fine print didn't really occur to me. And so essentially all I did was liaise with the ASA, the union. I joined that straight away and made sure that everything seemed to be accordant with union standard. And from that point on, I didn't argue about. I certainly didn't have any leverage really to press a point on advances or royalty structures or anything of that nature. And nor did I really even know.
And as a debut author, I suppose that's often the case. But as Craig said, the Australian Society of Authors is an Australian organisation that is very receptive and responsive to any questions authors might have about things like contracts. So they're a good place to go. So now that you're fully fledged and very experienced, what do you look at in a contract? What draws your attention, or do you just still sign away?
It's varied over the years. I do take more notice of them, and the advances go up and down, and the different rights that you have go back and forth. In the end, I think you, even if you feel like the advance is not what you'd like, which it never is, and the rights change, you make your choices based on where you are in your career, and you try to be as informed as possible, both about what how it compares, and what you need yourself from at that point in your career. You could hold out and hold out and hold out for the best deal, and it might never come. And meanwhile, people are forgetting you in, you know, they don't see you in the library, they don't see you in a bookshop, and you become invisible. So you make your choices based on that. If you want to maintain visibility, you go for it. But yeah, I think you become a bit more aware of things, but yep.
Yeah, look, things were a little different for me with my first contract with Fremantle Press, given that it was largely unsolicited. And, I mean, part of the beautiful thing about Fremantle Press is that you do accept unsolicited, which means not sent under the auspices of an agency. You know, you're free to send your manuscripts through to the publisher, to the slush pile.
We never call it that.
Why call it that? With the expectation that it will get read with, you know, a certain amount of time and integrity. However, my second novel, Jasper Jones, I was under the warm embrace of an agency at that stage. I knew what an agent was now. I'd grown up a little bit. And, you know, it was through their guidance that I started to pay a bit more attention to my contracts and working out what was actually really valuable, what was worth fighting for, you know, what clauses you could bend to your favour. It's not
and
always.
And what are those now?
Well, it's not necessarily always about the advance, to be honest with you. Because obviously, if you want to receive a royalty, you need to pay out of that advance. So let's say, for example, you receive an advance of $10,000. You need to sell X amount of copies to work through that advance, and after that, you start earning a royalty. So you need to be confident in the fact that you're going to sell that. Well, you're going to sell out of that advance in order for you to start, for that royalty clause to start moving into effect. Look, the most important thing for me in negotiating Australian contracts is that I retain my world rights with the expectation that you're going to sell into other territories. A lot of bigger publishers will fight tooth and nail to keep world rights because they're enormous conglomerates and they want the ability essentially to sell the work, sell the IP into large markets like the US and the UK and some translation territories. But what's really valuable for a writer is to hold onto those and sell them independently. That way you have a bit more control over, you know, who the best fit for your work is. You know, you can spread the field a little bit and find the right publisher because that is integral to the success of your novel, finding the right team. There are other things like royalty structures now, ebook royalties and audio rights actually are becoming you know, really, really important. A lot of people are starting to digest books more and more through the spoken word. And so fighting for those rights and establishing what the new norms are in these emerging fields is really important as well. So it does get a little more detailed than what it was for me initially.
No, that's interesting because, you know, we can get into a bit of the detail. Basically, a contract between a publisher and an author is, in our terms, very much a partnership. The author brings the content and the publisher produces, markets, distributes, and, you know, sells the book. So it's in those terms that the publisher also takes the financial risk on the project, and it might only last 2 years of blood, sweat, and tears, whereas the author spent 10 or 15 years of blood, sweat and tears on a project, but that's essentially how it works for new writers, I would think. So in terms of the structure of a normal contract, it would be that you talk about the title of the book is embedded in the contract. In many cases, the title of the book in the contract is a working title and rarely becomes the title of the book at the end of the day. Have you found that with your books? I know with a couple of yours, Alan, they completely change for all sorts of reasons.
Prime Cut started out as Chinese Whispers, and I was really happy with that title, but by the time it got to the point of becoming a thing that you need to market, there was a great deal of discussion about how marketable that title was. There was a number of factors. One was there was another crime novel out by a more famous author called Chinese Whispers, so that immediately makes it more difficult to sell. There's also the idea of trying to find a theme for the cover of the book, and nobody seemed to be able to know what to do with Chinese Whispers, whereas turning it into Prime Cut, it immediately sounds more crimey, and there were sharp edges on the cover of the book, and it just kind of melded into that. In the end, I wasn't too precious about the title because I'd written a book, I was getting published, I was excited about that. And I also needed to step back and recognise that there was a certain level of expertise in the people who knew how to market books, that I should respect their knowledge and their experience of doing that. So for them to come up with the cover, suggest new titles, and to have that partnership of various shared skills and expertise.
Is that the same in your case, Craig? Rhubarb was way before my time. I must have been 8 or 9.
Yeah, I've had a number of... I mean, you lose just that little element of control once you move into other territories and that are so far away. So I had a number of title changes for Jasper Jones. There's lots of, you know, Le Secret de Jasper Jones, and, you know, The Secret of Jasper Jones became a popular one. In Germany, I think they changed it to Who's Afraid of Jasper Jones in a kind of Virginia Woolf... kind of way, but the strangest one was Turkey. Where they changed the title of Jasper Jones to God's Forgotten Children. And I don't know why, but they didn't consult with me, but it seemed to work. It's just, it's a massive bestseller for whatever reason in Turkey. I'm a big deal there. To the extent where they bought the rights to Rhubarb, so if you have a successful book, generally they want to eat up your catalogue. And they were in a huge rush to get Rhubarb out and to translate it quickly. Translation is the other thing that just removes you a step from the process, because I don't speak Turkish, so I have absolutely no idea how the translation really worked, or, you know, how closely they adhered to the rhythm and the cadence of the original work. But with Rhubarb, I do know they're in such a hurry to translate it that they literally tore the book into 4 separate sections and gave it to 4 separate translators who then just mashed it together at the end and just rushed it onto the shelf as quickly as possible. And, you know, it was largely out of my hands. There's nothing really, you know, you just got to trust your publisher and trust their intentions and their integrity, or things like that kind of can happen.
The sort of second thing that comes up in a contract, of course, is the rights and territories that connect the contract, the deal, the partnership between the two parties, and typically it is you know, say world rights for the book and also print rights and ebook rights. Is that still standard? If, of course, you don't negotiate the world rights, but it's print and ebook as the standard, and then the royalties flow in the contract from that. And typically, can you tell us about what the royalties are for that, if you want to, if you remember?
Well, I've just been through this process, so I've kind of come a little bit full circle with how I approach contracts. My next work, I was in between agencies, and so I because I look after my own interest with my film projects, I just have a lawyer now who are just brilliant. You just give them all the hard things and they go in and fight on your behalf. And so I negotiated my own contract for my next novel. And as I mentioned earlier, so e-books and audio rights are really an emerging... I mean, they're always very important, but they're starting to eat up a larger share of how people are digesting books. So it's really important. For me, I prefer things to be incentivized, and so I like to have a rising royalty. You can negotiate for a rising royalty, which means you start at a certain rate, so let's just say a flat rate of 10%, and after a certain amount of sales, you might then move up to 12.5%. Further along, you might move up to 15%. I don't know how exciting this is for you, but these numbers will also shift in terms of what kind of edition you're talking about. So if you come out with a hardback edition, your royalty rate will be a little bit different to, say, B and C format paperbacks as well. Then you move into discounted titles and, you know, trade paperbacks and whatnot. You're looking at probably a reduced rate for discounted titles, which are... more often than not, bulk purchases that places like Big W and Kmart and whatnot they make. So it gets a little bit tricky. My advice really would be to work under the auspices of an agency if you can, but if that is not available to you, attain the services of a dedicated arts lawyer. They are just worth their weight in gold, which is typically what they charge you. But it is really worth it, and they go in there and fight for you. I also wanted to clarify earlier about the world rights. It doesn't always necessarily... if you're working without an agent, it can obviously be in your benefit to keep your world rights with your publisher. So, for example, with Fremantle Press... Jane will be able to speak to this at greater length, but most publishers, most independent publishers, will have their own dedicated world rights team, and they go to the festivals and tour the book, and they will sell it on into various territories on your behalf.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I've found by moving to an agency and then having those contracts gone over by somebody else, having spent 20 years on contracts in the documentary world, I was happy to leave them behind and let somebody else deal with that. So that is a real good thing to have. But the ASA and other, I think that Craig has mentioned, they're the other outlets you can follow. Just a little anecdote about back to translations. The thing about the Kato Kwong novels is that there's a big thing about cryptic crossword clues. The French translator didn't bother consulting at all. They were just happy to go with it because, you know, they were fine. But the Spanish and German translators were really pissed off at my cryptic crossword clues, because how the hell do you translate them and keep them within the spirit of the plot? So it's the first time I've ever been trolled by a whole bunch of translators from different countries. They were sending me abusive emails and... maybe that's why I'm not in Spain and France and Germany anymore. But
so the other, I guess, major part of the contract is as Craig and Alan said, what we call subsidiary rights, and they relate to things like audiobooks, film and television rights, international rights, audio rights, all of that sort of thing that are not to do with the key publishing sales of the print or ebook. And it's very much there where a lot of publishers will operate and be active in trying to sell those rights to producers, to foreign publishers and through their own agency network. So if we talk a little bit about that, often, you know, as debut authors, you wouldn't have really focused on that. But I wonder for the audience here if you could say... knowing that there are those rights there and that they will be part of a contract, does that influence how you would write a book? Knowing that, oh, this might be available on you know, it might become a movie. I should write it more in this way. I mean, my advice would be no, you write for the book, and the flow on is a benefit, because it's never a guaranteed. It's probably the hardest thing to do is to sell those subsidiary rights, and all publishers do focus on the print and the ebook.
No, I think if you start writing for a maybe down the track, then you're stuffed from the word go, really. You write what you're going to write, and if people want to buy it around the world, that's a bonus, but you really got to focus on what the writing is. Prime Cut got taken up by a BBC Wales radio drama, so it was interesting for it to be turned into a radio drama, of all things. And I didn't really have a whole bunch of say over what they were going to do with it, and I was quite happy not to. But if I'd known they were going to, one, swap the Geordie characters for Welsh characters, and then not mention the fact that Sunderland won the FA Cup, I probably wouldn't have signed up. But apart from that, they did a really good job with it. They changed a whole bunch of things around that I didn't expect. They merged characters. They cut whole chunks out, like the FA Cup final. But it worked. I really liked what they'd done with it.
Because ultimately, the selling of the subsidiary rights like that, the audio rights or the film screen rights, for example, for publishers and for authors, is to sell more books. That's ultimately what we want to do, is people say, I've seen the movie, I want to go buy the book. You know, that's the key. Is that right? For you, say, for example, maybe you could both talk about your audio experiences and being involved in more and more now on the selection of the voice, the character who narrates or acts the part, Craig?
Yeah, look, those decisions aren't necessarily underpinned in my contract. It's... in contract terms, especially in film, they like to offer you this thing called meaningful consultation, which largely means nothing. It just means they have to listen to you and then forget everything you've said.
I wouldn't be so cynical.
I would. But it is certainly much more important now to... and there's a... Compared to, you know, when Rhubarb came out or even when Jasper Jones came out, there's a larger fleet of performers and people that are capable of because it's such an emerging field, you know, you do have a larger choice or a larger pool of people to choose from or insist on, as the case may be. A lot of writers want to do it themselves. You know, that's not too uncommon. I can't think of anything worse, really. But no, it's part of a collaborative process, and you know, it's in everyone's interest to find the right person to bring your text to life, via the audio book.
And Alan, with Marlborough Man, we went through a process of listening to auditions.
Yeah, well, there was two experiences. One was with Prime Cut, which when there was an audio version of that done by, I think, the Society for the Blind, and it was a really on the smell of an oldie rag type thing. And, I mean, it was great that it had been done, but, it was pretty low budget, and the voices... all of the Geordies became a kind of a general, generic Yorkshire ecky thump type thing. And all of the women's voices sound about 15 and pretty bogan, whereas Taser Tess isn't 15. So that was a different experience. I thought it was nice to have it done. When it got to Marlborough Man, it was Wave Sound, a very kind of professional out there company, and they found... some Geordie Australian actor, because Marlborough Man is written in the first person, and the first person has my accent. So you've got to find somebody like that to do the reading of it, and they found somebody, and he did a really good job. So they consulted on a whole bunch of things to do with different aspects of New Zealand culture or the language and how to pronounce things, which I had to then go off and ask other people how to pronounce things, but they were very involving.
And Craig, can you give us a bit more detail about the whole screen process of making the film and sorting that out?
Yeah, I can tell you how not to do it. For Jasper Jones, we actually sold the screen rights before it even hit the shelf, while it's still in manuscript form. And, again, I just... we weren't sure what it would quite become. And you know,
when you do sell the screen rights, it's really an option, and that can go on as an option for years and years until the producer can find the funding to actually convert it into making a movie.
Right. So what an option is essentially is the exclusive right for a producer or someone involved in film to produce your work. And so what they're essentially purchasing is a period of time to exclusively develop or adapt your novel for the screen. And the period of time that you have, can shift over time. But typically you give them 2 to 3 years at least, but there are check marks along the way that they need to hit in order for them to keep the option, to stop people from essentially just sitting on them for years and, you know, you're losing momentum. But look, what I look for now, given that, you know, I wrote the adaptation for Jasper and I'm involved in film, is that I typically want to adapt my own work. You know, I'm the closest to it. I feel like I'm the most qualified to tell that story in a different medium, just simply because, you know, I'm the originator of that content, and so I know it very intimately. And so now I'll insist on, being the first choice, essentially, to adapt the work. It's a tricky one. I'm going through it right now, whether or not you wait or you sell. So I have a manuscript that's going to market internationally at the moment, and so the question is, do I try to sell my option now to a great producer, which sweetens the pot potentially for overseas sales because they know that an adaptation is coming, and it sort of settles their nerves a little bit, because to have a screen adaptation is typically quite good for sales of the book, or do you wait, see what the fate of the book is, and use that as leverage to get a better production deal, for example, and shopping around to other people. So there's different ways to approach it, and it's going to be different for different novelists working in different genres with different ambitions, I suppose. The most important thing, I think, is that you have some degree of involvement over how a producer is looking to develop your story, because once it's taken out of your hands and once you have signed it, you know, they have the exclusive right to do whatever they want with it, essentially, you know. So to keep a toe in the process is important, I think. Something worth
fighting. Do you agree with that, Alan? Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I've had the Kato Kwong series has come under option, and that has wandered on and on and on for various reasons. And the primary reason there is that the funders and the broadcasters like to have box office names starring in that, and the box office Chinese Australian stars are few and far between, so it's going to be a really hard one to cast. You can cast all of the people around him, but convincing them of the box office of the star is a much harder one. Marlborough Man is, you might not know this, it's looking quite an advanced stage of possibly being optioned, and that's going to be a lot easier to cast, because you've got a whole bunch of good Kiwi actors, there's Poms in there and everything, so it's going to be an easier piece to do. But I'm also, from my own filmmaking background, I've also learned to take these kind of things with a pinch of salt, because I know how flaky us film producers are as well, that things can look really, really promising and then fall over. It's not there until you've signed the dotted line, really.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to open it up for questions, so if you can put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you. In the meantime, we'll talk about copyright and how do you understand what copyright is when you're signing a contract and who owns copyright and how important it is to be clear on that. Craig?
Well, largely, you understand that you know it's a legal framework. You can't move. You know, it's quite rigid. It's very hard to argue one way or another in terms of copyright, but knowing what your rights are important I think.
So that every writer is the owner of the copyright, and in terms of licensing it to a publisher, it, usually the clause has something to do with for the term of copyright, or the legal term of copyright. And do you know what that is? It's your life plus 70 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that's essentially how long you can publish a book without having to then to renegotiate it. If the book, of course, is in print or it doesn't fall over or the contract terminates or anything like that. So that's a very interesting and important thing for authors to know, that you do not lose your copyright. So if anyone says, you know, you've got to sell your copyright to me, then it's not correct. So always find or get some advice on that if that's an issue. The other thing is the author's warranty. When we do publish a book or negotiate with a writer, we do ask writers to warrant to indemnify publishers of things like ownership of copyright and that it is your own original work. So we want to avoid any issues with plagiarism or defamation and things like that. Has that ever cropped up for you too? Naming the wrong name or, you know?
Yeah, well, certainly in the field of crime writing and in the earlier books, I was drawing from some real-life crimes. I don't do that anymore because I've realised how dodgy it can be, but it can come back to bite you and you need to be very careful. And you are ultimately responsible as the writer for not defaming anybody or trashing anybody's life. And I'm still going through the process now with the next New Zealand book, Doom Creek, whereby there's certain names and descriptions of people, because it was a pretty small valley I was living in, and they knew where I lived. that's part of the problem, actually. To try and avoid them thinking that it is them, even though it is them... I've had to, you know, change the names and descriptions and try and distance from that. It can be quite a shaky area, but I take advice from my editor, Georgia, who I think also has legal experience. Yeah, so she's great. Georgia.
Up the back.
Hello, my name is Simon. I've got two questions,
yes.
One relating to defamation and the other one about screen rights.
Sorry, Simon, I was getting to you once, Alan.
Oh, no worries. I was comfortable standing here. It was great. So, Craig, my question for you is, did you independently negotiate the rights for the manuscript that's now being turned into a film yourself, or did you do that as part of your publishing? And then my question for you about defamation is, how much of the process was involved to look at the characters and to distinguish if there was going to be any legal issues?
I'll answer the second one first, because it's a bit faster. So there's a legal department at your publisher who will comb through a manuscript and look for anything that is potentially dangerous. So far, I have evaded capture. However, in Jasper Jones, there was one thing I had to change. There's a character called Jeffrey Liu who is very enamoured with cricket and loves Doug Walters. And there was a line where Doug Walters was described as an alcoholic, and that was potentially defamatory, and so I had to change it to lunatic. It's fine. to answer your first question, sorry, you were asking me how I go about administering my own rights for screen. It's tricky what's just happened. So I've shifted agencies, and while I was shifting agencies, I looked after my own rights, my own Australian New Zealand rights for this next manuscript. It's very boring, I'm sorry. However, I have now signed with an agency in the UK with an agent who specialises in novelists that write for screen, and so it's in my interest to have my new agent look after the screen adaptation aspects of this next manuscript. So I've handed things over there. But with film projects and developing original film projects here in Australia, look, the pool of money for film is so slender in Australia that you really don't have much leverage to make huge arguments about script payments or whatnot. You typically adhere to what is standard. And so for having a film agent here, really all I'd be paying for is the network access, which I don't really need, to be honest with you. There aren't that many producers and most people would take my call. So what I do need, though, is legal assistance. And so to have an arts lawyer, you know, assisting me with a contract and whatnot is just absolutely essential, I think, yeah.
I think also it's very interesting in this day and age with selling screen rights. There's a lot more interest and demand for it from producers, and I've found that they've come knocking at the door far more than they have in the last 5 years. And that's probably as a consequence of the whole Netflix, Stan and Disney thing that's happening out there, where they're hungry for content and they suddenly realise that, duh, you know, writers and book publishers have that content. So they're having another look at what's available, and it doesn't necessarily have to be big sellers or the blockbusters. They're after really good content, and they know what their market wants, and sometimes it's something that could be just for Australian, New Zealand consumption, or they want, you know, something for worldwide because they'd be able to fund it better. So it's a really interesting time now, that and the audio thing that's happening.
Mm.
Question there?
Yes, good morning. Very interesting panel. My name is Tom Murrell. I'm an author and company director. I'm interested in your business models and in particular your revenue streams and what you see as the future of hard copy books versus other platforms which are digital, you know, podcasting or audio or film. So just interesting in breakdown of your revenue streams from your business model.
Typically, it's still the print and the ebook are the biggest income streams for a publishing company, an independent smaller publishing company like Fremantle Press. But I would argue that most publishers, you know, the primary focus is on print books. Ebooks are increasing, but they've plateaued now, and there's not typically the return on an ebook is much smaller than a print book for obvious reasons. They're sold at different kind of pricing points, and also the royalty stream to authors is a different breakdown to a print book. So print books are really our bread and butter, and they still will continue to be. Audio, when you sell the subsidiary rights, you're always going through a third party, so there's a split there, so the audio rights are coming through, but they're fickle, they're like film. They might one day want crime, the next day they want children's, you know, young adult stories, for example. So you're at, you know, they just pick and choose what they want. They don't necessarily pick everything that we produce. Whereas every book that we produce, we get out into the marketplace and out into the bookstores.
Yeah, interesting. My revenue stream. Yeah, look, Jane knows.
I thought you were talking to me.
Jane knows the breakdowns in terms of audio to ebook to print sales, but better than
much smaller. Yeah.
But in terms of what royalty you receive, it does work out largely the same. So you'll argue for, say for example, an ebook retails for $9. You know, you'll argue, an author will argue for a higher royalty percentage, essentially to have your breakdown largely kind of the same as what a print sale would be, if that makes any sense, and the same with audio as well. However, audio now is really tricky because it's largely down to... So it used to be that you would buy a 18 CD set and put it in your car for a long drive or put it in your Discman or whatever, but now it's all subscription service, so it's a bit murky, and I've just been through this with negotiating the next contract. It's really hard to get breakdowns. In fact, the companies, the subscription services, will not give you breakdowns. They won't tell you how many streams you've had, how popular your book is, where it is in the charts, anything like that. So it is really, really difficult to get clear numbers. In terms of my revenue streams, I don't know how interesting this is, but you know, you rely on royalties. Subsidiary sales and things going to production. are really important as well. I've been enormously blessed over the since the release of Jasper Jones. There's been a number of stage adaptations which have kept me alive, and obviously the film adaptation as well. There are other things to come off the film adaptation, like the film tie-ins. For whatever reason, the book purchasing publish audience loves film tie-ins. You see a cover with a film on it, it just flies off the shelf for whatever reason. So I was very fortunate in that regard as well. And then there's new work, you know, new films in development, etc. Keep the wolves from the door.
My revenue stream, every 3 months or so, I open my emails and there's a statement saying I've got some money, and that's great. And that's about the strength of it. It's not a particularly sophisticated one as yet, but we live in hope.
You do know the Macquarie University in 2015, and they're updating this, did a study on authors and writers in Australia, and the average income for a writer per book that they've spent 10 or 15 years writing is about just under $13,000. So you all have to keep your day jobs. So.
Somebody owes me about $4,000.
Any other questions then? Yes?
David McDermott. If you've got a draft book and you think it's got some potential as a film and you want to use an agent, what would you look for in an agent? How would you choose that agent?
Can I first say, do go onto our podcasts for last year, because we did have a session on agents and so on. So have a listen to that. But
so your question
both
is
have agents.
Your question is if you have a manuscript that you feel has potential to be developed into a screen project, how do you go about choosing the right agent for you? First and foremost, I think finding an agent that fundamentally believes in what you're about and what you're doing is the most important thing, rather than worrying about subsidiary rights or anything like that. I think it's about sending your manuscript out and having that connection with someone that believes in you to the extent that they're going to do the hard yards and really work for your interests. In Australia particularly, it doesn't necessarily matter who your agent is in terms of getting you an opportunity to have your novel adapted for screen. If the novel's good enough, in this current climate, you're going to have producers, as Jane was mentioning, you're going to have producers give it interest. More and more producers are looking for adaptation work, things that have an existing audience. Like publishers, producers are looking to mitigate risk, and so are screen funding agencies and distributors and investors. And so if there is a novel with an existing audience that are going to be interested in seeing it on the screen, then that gives you an enormous leg up. Rather than trying to sell an original, you know, original idea to screen. So there's great appetite at the moment for adaptations. So my advice to you, sir, would be just to find the right agent that's going to look after your literary interests, and the rest will hopefully take care of itself.
I think we've actually run out of time now. I'm sorry about that. We're going to have to wrap it up. But if you've got any questions, come and see any of us afterwards, that would be great. So please join me in thanking Alan and Craig. I'm now going to hand over to Holden Shepherd. So once we organise all of that, I'll come back onto the stage and welcome the new panel. Thanks.